right, the most exciting new podcast about indie films ever.
Yes, that would be Indie Scene officially. Mm-hmm. We've left the slowdown in the dust after two wonderful seasons, mm-hmm. And now we're launching. It's pretty much going to be the same thing, just getting together talking about independent movies month after month. And that's not to say that we won't be talking about independent or slow cinema, you know, in the future, but we are going to mm-hmm. be focusing more on just general independent movies and what's going on with that stuff. And Sajiwa, you've got a movie that's in progress. We'll be catching up on all those details and all that great stuff. Mm-hmm. You wanted to say something. I'm hogging the intro.
That's okay. I said, just like slow, the previous podcast, but this time much more exciting, 50% more exciting, more controversial. We'll have bigger opinions. More clashes, more drama.
Maybe.
And you guys get to see the beard and the Sri Lanka cricket shirt today.
Repping the colors.
That's right. Well, laundry situation. And also, while I'm editing, I don't shave typically. So soon, in a couple of days, I'll be able to shave.
All right. Is there a significance to the cricket besides Laundry Day? Are they? I have no idea about sports in general. So are they playing now? Are they doing well?
They've always done pretty well in the world of cricket.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, I don't know if they're playing now, but I can do a quick update on the movie.
Well, let's first introduce
our guest.
Yes, our handsome, similarly bearded, I feel out of place on this show.
It's all right.
Guest, the chairman and professor of film at Baylor University, Chris Hansen, returning to the show. Well, returning to kicking the seat, but mm-hmm. you were also a guest on The Slowdown some months back. Now you're here to talk about your latest film, which just came out. You can rent it from Amazon. And is it available on all streaming platforms, as they say?
Pretty much all. Amazon, iTunes, Vimeo On Demand, a bunch of cable on demand like Comcast, Dish, DirecTV, Xfinity. I guess that's Comcast. I can't remember which is which.
I think that's all subsumed under the same rubric. But the film is seven short films about our marriage. I'm doing the parentheses to get that right.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, great, great filmmaker Chris Hansen, somewhat unknown in Hollywood, but hopefully that will change soon.
For sure. So, Sajiwa, what's going on before we dive into Chris's mm-hmm. film? What's going on with the Secret Society for Slow Romance?
Exciting new film coming out. It'll revolutionize the indie film world. All the color work is done. All the image work is done. I wasn't happy with the sound design, so I took everything away. All the ambient sounds, all the music, all the effects.
It's a silent film now?
Now it's just dialogue. Now I'm rebuilding it. I will make the Slam Dance and Sundance deadlines that are later this month. So in a couple of days, I hope to have it finished. And a little tip for all you indie filmmakers out there. I did a $10 ad on Film Freeway saying my movie exists. Come check it out, film festivals. 80 film festivals, including some that I had wanted to apply to, sent me invites and pass and discount codes, sometimes as much as 50% off the submission fee. So that's $10 well spent.
I'd say so. That's amazing.
So it's coming along soon. You'll be the first one of the first people to see it. I'll be in touch in a couple of days. But yeah, I'm very happy with the movie. It looks great, and it just didn't sound like New York. So we're changing that.
I like the idea of it being a silent film and you just like writing up all these cards for all your dialogue to keep flashing in between the cuts.
Yeah. Can you imagine, like, imagine if seven short films about our marriage were a silent film, but all the dialogue was on cards.
That would be great. Yeah.
It'd be three times as long.
Ian, that movie would make $5 instead of the usual $15 my movies make.
But hey, as long as you're still in the black.
That's right.
But all right, so Chris, tell us about this film. Why don't you, I sometimes will do like a quick setup, like what it's about, but since we've got the person here who dreamt up the whole thing and wrote it and shot it and put it all together, why don't you pitch us your movie? Tell us what seven short films about our marriage is about.
It's a story, it's funny when it, I was being, the film was being introduced at a film festival, and the person accidentally called it Seven Short Films About One Marriage. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good title too. Because so, it is, it's essentially seven vignettes that center around the story of one marriage. And so we visit that marriage over seven periods, over a period of time, over about 14 years is the way it's structured in the movie. And so we're kind of dipping in and out of their relationship at different points, especially at what I wanted to do was to deal with points that most marriages have as stressors or events that they have to deal with, like early marriage and dealing with money and, you know, trying to figure out how to survive, and infertility and, you know, death of a loved one, and those kinds of things are all things that marriages deal with, or people in relationships deal with in different ways. And so the intent was really to tell this story of a marriage over a course, you know, sorry, I'm rambling, but the real intent was I wanted to talk about marriage, and not in a romantic comedy way, and not in mm-hmm. a big romantic drama way where it was built around a breakup and then they fall back in love. And I wanted to tell it in all the kind of the ins and outs that most marriages actually deal with. Many of those are small, but they can become big if people don't deal with them directly or deal with them well. And that's really why it was structured around that time period of having to kind of come and go, because those things don't all happen over a couple of months. They happen over many years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the festival response in some detail? Because you played Harlem International, and you played CineQuest and a bunch of other festivals, and those yeah. are big. Those are big festivals. Yeah, talk about that experience.
Sure, you're very, very pleased. I mean, so CineQuest was our world premiere, which I was thrilled by, because I've tried to get into CineQuest before and just hadn't quite cracked it yet, and to get in there and have that as our world premiere was really exciting. And then we went to CineQuest in March of 2020 and halfway through the festival. It was a 2-week festival, so it was a really long festival. We were supposed to screen three times.
Wow. And
we had our premiere screening. I was going to be there for two of the screenings. We had our premiere screening, and then the next day the festival shut down for the pandemic, and then all festivals shut down for the pandemic. So we did have we had a number of virtual screenings. I mean, I feel fortunate that festivals continued to operate, because in the immediate aftermath, I think people were scrambling, trying to figure out what to do. And the first virtual experience we had was with the Dallas Video Fest. Bart Weiss, who's a great film programmer, and he wanted to show it, and he had already accepted it, and then he had to pivot, but he went all virtual and all free, just to get people to come and watch the films. I had a great experience with that. And yeah, we screened at Harlem and at Naples International and at the Method Fest, which is about, as the title indicates, about method acting. So mm-hmm. It's about, you know, performance. They really focus on films that have great performances. So we're really honored to be invited to screen there as well. And they actually did a drive-in festival experience, because you couldn't have it in a theater, but at least it was an in-person experience. Of course, I couldn't go because Los Angeles was on fire with COVID and nobody was traveling much. So, but yeah, I think we had a pretty good festival run. It was just weird. It was a weird experience to have the whole festival run be virtual, or almost the whole festival run, and to have several, Q&A sessions that were like this, that were all that were on Zoom and virtual, and they weren't bad. I mean, I had good experience with that. It's just it's the difference is, and I'm sure you guys have been to film festivals, you know, when you see a film that you really like and the filmmaker's there, and then you go and chat with them in the lobby, and then the filmmakers get to network with other people, and you couldn't really do that. I know some of the festivals really worked hard to circumvent that issue and had, like, you know, Zoom meetups for the filmmakers, but I'm the wallflower in the corner in the Zoom meetups. I'm just like, so it's a challenge, but it's not exactly what I would have wanted for the film in terms of launching it, because going to the film festivals and doing Q&As and meeting with people who enjoyed the film is part of the kind of the lifeblood of the experience for an indie filmmaker like me. But I was grateful that it was able to screen, and through that we were able to get some interest from distributors and stuff like that.
Cool. Tell me about how the idea kind of came together. Specifically, I mean, it's about a young couple. I think we meet them after college. That's the impression.
Right,
because the thing I one of the things I dig about the movie is we don't get timestamps on any of these events, except towards the very end where we find out we've been watching something for 14 years, but we're not sure as they jump through time, like, is this 1 year later? Is this 7 years later? We don't quite know. But I picked up that these folks were just out of college. So they're like probably 22, 23 years old and they're getting married. It's an interracial couple, which is an issue that comes up right at the very beginning and then also kind of circles back at the end. Was this something that you had always had in mind? And can you talk about the decision to explore a mixed, black groomsman, white bride kind of a story, as opposed to just, a traditional, two white people falling in love, kind of the Hollywood blockbuster romance?
Yeah, the traditional two white people falling in love sounds funny. Yes.
It's a genre.
It turned out to be kind of a stroke of luck that came to me. You might have guessed, and this might be one of your questions for later, that this is somewhat based on my own experience of marriage. I've been married for almost 30 years. And so, we've been through a lot of ups and downs. And
in the early days, you were black and now you're white.
I'm not going to say yes to that, even as a joke.
Good idea.
I am mixed race, so I will give you cover for that if you want to make the joke.
You're mixed race?
Yes, my father was black and my mom was white.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you for telling me.
These lights will not give any indication. I just look pasty and.
I'm half Italian, and I think I'm darker than you. So,
there you go.
But
I'm part Italian as well.
I do live in Texas, so I get a lot of sun.
Sometimes I get mistaken for Ethiopian.
Okay. As I was writing, and I was writing a character who's an aspiring filmmaker. I was finding it was harder to separate myself from the character. Like, I wanted to write and use my own experience, but I didn't want to be writing only about my marriage. And I decided to make him an African-American person because I thought this is going to separate it from me. Because if I make this character African-American, I can't write him like myself, because his experiences will, by definition, be different. Mm-hmm. And that really turned out to be a key for kind of helping me understand the character and understand their relationship, and really in creating conflict, not necessarily between them, but in the opening short film where they, he's experiencing conflict through the father-in-law, the future father-in-law, who obviously has some issues with his daughter marrying a black man. And so it became this foundational thing for their relationship that they thought would not be a problem, that they would be easy, it would be easy for them to overcome, but that nevertheless what was an issue that continued for them. So it was really, I don't know if stroke of luck is the right term, but it helped me to craft a narrative that was more interesting, I think, than it would have been otherwise.
Now, how did you approach writing? You've established you wanted to create a character who is different from yourself, but in terms of writing a character who is different from yourself, from that point of view, how did you stay authentic, or how did you create what you imagined to be an authentic black person? Did you consult with friends or relatives or whatever who might have, might be from that community?
Yeah, definitely.
And the actor, it looks like the actor put in a lot of stuff.
The actor was very, influential in, honestly, one of the things one of the producers said to me when we brought Drez on was, he said, it's your words, but he's saying them in his way, which is true of all actors, but it was especially true, I think, here, because, you know, it wasn't that Drez was rewriting things, but it was, you know, filtered through his experience and his way of speaking that was different, that is different than mine. And so he brought that character to life. But yeah, I also, you know, I had some friends read it who are, you know, people of color, and I wanted to make sure that I was accurately representing their experience. One of whom was a really good friend and a colleague who is African-American and in an interracial marriage. And he said, you know, it really resonated for him because he and his wife were told many of the same things were going to be a problem for them because they were an interracial couple. And he said, the truth is the things that we dealt with were all the typical marriage stuff. And, you know, the interracial stuff wasn't really an issue for us, although it might've been for people outside of their relationship. So that kind of resonated because I didn't want the whole thing to be about race. I don't think I qualified to write that. And I felt like, you know, I could write a story about a relationship that had race as a dimension, but not that race was the only dimension of their relationship. That's something that the lead actor said to me too, when he said he read the script and there's some stuff about his interest in Langston Hughes and adapting, you know, Langston Hughes' story. And he said, as he was reading it and seeing that stuff, he was afraid it was going to be like a character who was a Black person. And that was all that he was. And he said, because I am Black, but that's not all that I am.
Yeah.
And he said, and that was the actor talking to me. And he said, but as I read it, I didn't feel like that's the sole focus of the story. That's just one dimension of his character. And that's what he really liked about it.
A movie that's all about race would be like a 14-hour Netflix miniseries that never ends for 10 seasons.
Or it's a Spike Lee movie, or right. It's a, you know, Ava DuVernay movie, which, you know, they're much more qualified to speak to that than I am.
Well, even Spike Lee movies are about the individual characters, really.
Absolutely, heavily, no doubt.
With detail, race details. But yeah. One more thing on the matter. My new movie has my character who, you know, ethnic background is not given, probably South Asian. And the female character who looks white, we don't know. So I was thinking about how to pitch this to the world. So I came up with this little formula that a lot of people we know are really from Indo-European countries. It's a language group that English, Sinhala, Tamil, all kinds of languages. Most languages belong to Indo-European language and culture. All of the Americas, most of Europe, India, Sri Lanka, and Australia, right? That's like most of the world that I want to play in. So that background plus democracies plus multi-religious, multi-ethnic countries, those seem to be the countries that create the most cinema and have the most film festivals. So I think there's culturally a lot of places we want to tell stories about or play our movies in have vast similarities. Like these two characters in your movie are really from the same, you know, cultural landscape, even though ethnically they're classified as two different types of people.
Yeah, true. I think that the thing that interests me about them as characters is that, you know, yes, she's white and he's Black, and yes, they both come from the same place. They met in college, you know, but their life experiences can be vastly different up until that point, and that's going to affect the relationship. You know, her father coming to him and saying, "I'm not a racist, but I'm worried about you having, you know, mixed race children, and how that's going to be difficult for you," is like, that's her background. That's the person who raised her, and she doesn't think like that, but obviously her family does, or at least someone in her family does.
Yeah, a universal problem everywhere.
Yeah. So
whether it's America or little tribes in some, you know, far off place,
I'm
having
sure.
The same objections. Go ahead, Ian.
No, I agree. I understand it's a problem that, you know, I don't know if we as a species are ever going to get over, you know, tribalism of some degree. So as far as the relationship stuff. I mean, you said that you're drawing on, you know, several decades of marriage. I'm not quite there yet, but, you know, I've been with my wife for a long time, and we've definitely had ups and downs, as you mentioned. How much of your life experience did you incorporate into the problems that these characters were having? And in dredging that up, if you did infuse them, you know, with that, did you talk to your wife about it? Was she involved in like the story process, kind of keeping you honest? Like, here's how I perceived it, and here's how I think you perceived it. How full of crap am I?
Also, can you add something about Bergman's life? I mean, the Bergman movies inspired this movie in part, right?
Not directly. I mean, I think, I mean, certainly Scenes from a Marriage is, you know, treading similar ground. I'm not gonna try to walk on the same stage that the maestro walks on. But to that question, Sujua, I'll say, I wrote the movie and I was trying to think of a title. And the first thing that popped into my head, unbidden, not connected to Bergman at all, was this is like Scenes from a Marriage. And I was like, that'd be a great title if right. Bergman hadn't used it already. So from that, I came up with what I think of as a modern version of it, seven short films about our marriage. And the short films, obviously, and the hour imply a storyteller. Mm-hmm. You know, so in that sense, and I haven't really gotten into this too much with Q&As and stuff, is he the storyteller? And so is it from his perspective? I mean, I think that's a viable question. I tried to write it, to go to Ian's question, from with the idea that I was giving both points of view kind of equal ground in the arguments. In other words, I didn't want anybody to be obviously wrong or right all the time. I wanted it to be a situation where you could kind of see both points of view. Now, no, I didn't. I did ask my wife to read it, and she didn't get around to it for quite a while until we were in production. And then she had a few objections. But mostly, I think, because in some places, you'd pretty close to our relationship, and she didn't like that there were things that felt kind of personal. But the funny thing was, when I asked people to read it, I remember one of the producers read it. We were traveling somewhere for an event, and he read it on the plane sitting next to me across the aisle. And of course, that's nerve-wracking. I'm like, what page is he on? But I saw him wiping his eyes at some point, and he said, honestly, I felt like you were in my bedroom, like writing scenes that I had argued with my wife. So I was like, okay. So, and I got that response from other people too, that it felt like, it felt very truthful and authentic to their experience. And that's when I felt like, yeah, I'm drawing from my own experience, but I'm not, my experience is not terribly unique when it comes to marriage. I mean, you know, different personalities might have different problems or different arguments, but a lot of couples have the kinds of arguments or the kinds of challenges that we had. I think and further to answer your question a little bit more, Ian, I feel like I was drawing on the first three parts are really drawn from the kinds of things that my wife and I dealt with, except for the interracial stuff, because obviously we didn't deal with that.
Just real quick, was there any element in that, say, that first section, if you swapped out the race issue for just the disapproving parent issue, did you deal with any of that? Or do you guys all get along with your in-laws, kind of a thing?
I get along great with my in-laws. The funny thing is, that was, I think, one of the things that bothered my wife, because she thought I was painting her father as a racist. And I was like, no, furthest thing from the truth. Like, her father, I will say this, her father, when she got married, it had nothing to do with me. He really wasn't ready for her to get married yet. And so I had an awkward conversation when I asked him for her hand in marriage, which is something that was important for her, where we didn't know each other very well, but it was a very awkward conversation as he was changing the brakes of her car, which would have been a good setup for this too. But, and so he literally never looked at me because he was working the whole time. And he was talking about, you know, not really, essentially he wasn't ready for it. But he, he assented, at least to my asking her.
And well, I would assume that if he didn't approve, then he would have asked you to, you know, slide under the car and just grab this one bit. And,
sounds like a scene from Sopranos.
It was funny because he's the most thoughtful and generous person. One of the most thoughtful and generous people I know. And so this was his daughter, his oldest daughter. And he was wanting her to go to grad school. He didn't know me at all. And so I think it was just this very awkward conversation. And I literally just took the idea of an awkward conversation between the father-in-law and the future son-in-law and turned that into something completely different. So now the truth is, the day I got married, he started treating me like I was, you know, a part of the family. And it's never been, you know, I call him dad and, you know, give him a hug every time I see him. And he's just a wonderful person. But, you know, that was an awkward start. So.
when you do press interviews on Zoom for this movie, you should have your wife storm in and scream lies and storm back out.
Maybe for publicity. Right. She's not that interested in being a part of these things.
Add some drama.
But the part four at the college reunion, nothing like that ever happened with us, that event. But the story that they're telling about how they got together is essentially the story of how my wife and I got together, with some details left out. So I just, that was kind of my tribute to my wife. It was telling the story of how we got married in their story. Everything after that is really projection. You know, I'm trying not to spoil things, but neither my wife or I has had a parent pass away yet. And we haven't separated.
Yeah, don't say too much.
Yeah, we've never separated or had any, you know, issues that would push us towards that. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of projection in the second half of the film as to, you know, where their relationship would go. And honestly, some of that's in the interest of creating conflict that would drive us towards a conclusion of the film.
Mm-hmm. All right, soft handling of the filmmakers over. I have some controversial opinions. Okay. All right, these are some of my notes from immediately after watching it.
I do not know where he's going with this, so
I assume
do not endorse these opinions unless I
please rebut them right. If you feel
that's
the need.
Right, that's right. All right, just some stuff quickly. You can respond when I'm done with the list. So I said, good movie. People should watch it. One of the first movies to deal with an interracial marriage in a realistic late 20th, early 21st century way. But there hasn't really been. I mean, it's a controversial topic even in 2021, 22. So Hollywood doesn't deal with it because it's risky. But
deal with it by not mentioning it. I mean, you have an interracial relationship, and it's just a
thing. Unless you look at TV commercials, because like 90% of the TV commercials, you'd think that all of America was literally a melting pot of like interracial couples.
That's what I'm talking about. The example there is just have interracial couple in a show or mm-hmm. in a, you know, a commercial, and it's not remarked upon because mm-hmm. it is a normal thing. The truth is it is fairly normal, but
in New York it's very, it's super normal.
Yeah. And so part of me to speak to that was thinking I'm not doing anything groundbreaking or controversial by having them be an interracial couple. I actually thought maybe I was being naive even by having their race be an issue, but the truth is that
to some people it's
unquestionable issue. That our country race is still an issue, and interracial marriage can still be an issue. So it's in New York it might feel like it's unremarkable, but in other parts of the country it still is.
So. Definitely. So great acting by the actors. Noah, especially that actor, especially stood out. Both actors were good. Good direction. Great. Oh, the cinematography was awesome. Except maybe if you have to do a similar story, maybe think about doing the seven stories in some different styles that correspond to the time period. That might have been interesting, but
it was something we considered. It was a budgetary and time limitation. We had very limited amount of time to shoot it. But that was actually part of the thinking. So
yeah, because
there are very subtle differences in the image, the color and the look of those pieces but they're more subtle. So
yeah, then Ian would have gone, no, this is 2004. This is 2014.
Right, and so I was trying to avoid that, although my production designer was pestering me with questions about when is this, what kind of phone would they have? So we were trying to keep details light but correct.
A good production designer. And Ian, I'll give up the floor in a minute. The score was pretty good, but I think maybe more complex and energetic would have been better. But that's I'm doing sound for my own movie right now, so that's probably what I'm thinking about. So don't mind me on that one. I thought story 7 was really not needed. I think you could have stopped at 6, and that would have been both ambiguous and positive. What do you think?
Obviously, I disagree because I included 7. No, and the funny thing is, I disagree. I feel like I agree it would have been more ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And I think the ending is still somewhat ambiguous. You may not think so. I will say this. I didn't think the ending was that ambiguous, but I've still had many people. I've had people on our the film's Facebook say, What happens at the end? Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, I was trying to walk.
It's still ambiguous.
It's ambiguous, but not terrible. Not as ambiguous as ending at part 6 would have been.
That's right. Yeah. It's a little bit more. So my last controversial opinion question is, what did you think of distribution in this weird climate that we're in? Because you and I worked on one of your movies and we got New York Times, LA Times, Village Voice, bunch of like great press for where we started. This time things didn't go that well because of the weird COVID situation. What do you think?
Well, also some of those papers have changed their policies on what they're going to review. And that's, even I think the New York Times, when Where We Started came out, they would review any film that was playing in a New York theater for whatever period of
time. A week or so.
And so they reviewed it. They've changed that policy, mm-hmm. In part because of probably films like mine.
So, no, not yours, some other movie.
No, I don't mean because it was bad. The New York Times didn't give Where We Started a good review, but I don't mean that. I just mean the sheer number.
Sheer number.
Films like that. So, you know,
and people were in New York, people were gaming the system. Distributors were just putting it out for a week with no support just to get the New York Times coverage.
Yeah, that's exactly what they basically offered. So I wouldn't call it gaming the system as in playing their game. So, I would like to get more reviews. That's something we're working on. It is a challenge. The difference between when Where We Started came out to now, mm-hmm. which is something like 8 years.
2014 is when it came out, right?
2014. So 7 years. The landscape has changed dramatically for streaming cinema. You know, we didn't opt to have any theatrical screenings for this because it really wasn't an option. I mean,
theaters were shut down.
Yeah, when we planned everything with the distributor, there wasn't they weren't terribly supportive of that anyway because it's a small film, so we probably would have had to pay for some kind of release. But theaters are shut down. So who's going to go see, a movie like this?
They can.
So, it's hard to get reviews. Like I said, we're still working on it. It's through contacts, through a publicist and things like that. You know, we're getting some, they're taking a little longer than I'd have hoped, but it's just the reality of the streaming situation. Like
the pandemic.
But streaming in general. I mean, the pandemic, that's the thing I tell people, that we were headed towards this world of streaming already when the pandemic started. And then the pandemic really drastically accelerated it. So the reality is now, before the pandemic started, HBO or Warner Brothers wasn't releasing their whole slate of films on HBO Max, and now that streaming coverage is overtaking, smaller films and their streaming coverage. How do you get people who want to review, Malignant, which just came out, that's the only reason I'm just thinking of it, or Wonder Woman, to review a small indie film? They've just got to be committed to that. The reviewers who are doing it are the ones who are really committed to reviewing indie films. So
this is a 14-hour long conversation on the distribution. Totally. So totally. I'm gonna be quiet now. Ask away questions, Ian.
No, I mean they're all good. Good questions and points that I'm curious, and I'll have that 14-hour conversation. But I know our time here tonight is short. But tell me about casting. We've talked about Drez Ryan a little bit, and also China Walker. How did you find them? I mean, was it just through casting, or did you know people who recommended them? Because, you know, the performances are quite remarkable.
So I went through initially Backstage, you know, the online casting tool. Had never used it before, but a colleague of mine had used it for his previous film. So we listed, the only parts we listed on there for casting were the two leads and then her father, because it was such a meaty part with a long speech, much longer than what ended up in the final cut, that we really wanted to cast, you know, kind of a wide net to find those people. In the end, the only part we cast from Backstage was the father. The other two ended up being recommendations from other people, because while we were casting on Backstage, we were also considering, you know, we were talking to people about their recommendations. China had been in a couple of films by a colleague of mine, short films, when she was a student. Well, one when she was a student, one when she was not anymore. I teach at Baylor. She had been a student in the theater program at Baylor several years back, had finished and had gone out to California to do her MFA in performance at, I can't remember which, University of California school. And then, so she did our film right after she finished that MFA. Big challenge with China for me was she has a very young looking face. In fact, if you saw her without, you know, the makeup from the film, she could play 16 or 18 years old easy.
Was that part of an inside joke? Because the first time we see her, she's getting made up in her wedding gown, and she makes a remark like, I really wish I could see my face, or this doesn't look like me, or something like
that. Well, that was actually in the script, but it worked out pretty well, because one of the makeup art, so I was concerned she wouldn't be able to look old enough for the later scenes. But the makeup artist who had worked with China before as well said her philosophy of it was actresses look younger when you go fresh faced and clean. And as women get older, they wear more makeup to cover lines and things like that. And so she progressively made China from fresh face and clean to more made up by the end, except for that wedding scene when she was heavily made up because it was her wedding. And she said, this doesn't look like me at all. So we get the cleaner look after that. So that was our work with her. And Drez was recommended to me by another filmmaker who I'd met at a retreat some years earlier. And he had a small part in his film, which I had seen, but it was such a small part that you almost couldn't get much sense of it. Ironically, he was playing a filmmaker winning an award at a festival in that film. So he fit the part. But he sent in a video audition. They both did. And they just blew me away. I mean, and I showed Drez's video audition to several people, and they were like, oh, yeah, he's the one. I mean, it was that, like I said before, that combination of being a good actor, but also kind of hearing the words I'd written through someone else's voice that really brought them to life in a way that I hadn't even imagined before. So
related question, one of my young filmmaker friends wanted to hear about this. How difficult was it to work with SAG? I think you had one SAG actor, right?
We had two SAG actors.
Both actors.
The father,
no, some other actors.
Yeah, the father was a SAG actor. He'd been on several television shows and Gotham, the Batman show without Batman. And I can't think of the other one that he was known for. But and then the one who plays Noah's ex-girlfriend at the college reunion, she was SAG also. So yeah, it was not fun. I mean, I'm not going to recommend it, but you know, we had to, you know, hire a payroll company and give the money to the, you know, you pay the money into the payroll company before production begins so that they know that those people will get paid. And the thing is, SAG has all these rules.
And, or studios.
No, just rules for.
I know, but I think it came out from dealing with studios.
Well, sure, but I mean, they apply them to everybody. So they apply, you know, you work they can't work beyond 10 hours. They have to have certain perks, some of which are unrealistic for a small production. Mm-hmm. The thing is, once the actors get there, they want to be protected by SAG, and I totally respect that, but they get there and they just want to be part of the team. You know, our experience with those actors was fantastic. They were wonderful people, easygoing, easy to work with. they weren't checking the clock, you know, or anything like that. Working with SAG is a lot of paperwork. And trying to define, because we're at a university, they kept trying to call it a student film. And we're like, it's not a student film. There are students working on it. We're not a student film. We're trying to explain kind of what we do and who we are. And it was very confusing for them. And so, you know, I think we came up with something that worked and we signed a lot of paperwork and, you know, abided by the rules.
So to that point, because I don't know a whole lot about SAG or you know, how it is working with unions on films, but to what you were just saying, there's all these rules that you have to abide by and things that are, I guess, are requested, you know, the hours and things like that. But when you mentioned that the actors showed up and they want to be part of the team, is there like a SAG representative on set to make sure things are going smoothly? Is there anyone to like tell on you, or if someone doesn't, you know, there weren't enough green M&Ms in my trailer or some nonsense?
No, I'm sure that for larger films that's the case. And honestly, I have a friend, and I won't mention his film name or his name, but
good.
He was telling me about he worked with SAG and other unions, you know, Teamsters and things like that he had to deal with. And, you know, I don't think it was SAG who was trying to boycott him, but he said they sent like 12 protesters down just to, you know, stand there and with signs and shout. And like I said, I don't think this was SAG. So I think it was one of the other unions he was dealing with, like the Camry union or something. And, you know, so he said, he was telling me about tons of problems they had. And they weren't violating any rules. It was just they were working in a state where they didn't have to use the union. And so they chose in some cases not to, or, you know, he was protesting some behavior by a union employee that was inappropriate, and he fired that person, and that caused a stir. And so, you know, we just didn't have anything that controversial, but we really, literally from a union perspective, the only thing we were dealing with was two SAG actors, and it wasn't a union shoot. It wasn't a SAG shoot except for those actors. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have to abide by SAG rules for every other thing. And so I don't think we were big time enough for them to worry about us.
Okay. But one thing I wanted to mention about Drez's performance, perhaps you can talk about this shot. And again, I don't want to get into specifics here, but there is a scene in a parking garage where he is on the phone.
Figured that was the one you were going to bring up.
Well, I only watched this movie today, but it's still fresh in my mind, but I have to go back and watch the scene to keep myself honest here. I don't think we cut back to the person who's on the other end of the line. It's strictly on him. There's a couple of different angles of him in the garage, but it's just him on the phone. And yet I swear I saw the other person on the end of that phone. He was carrying, you heard the person's voice.
Yeah.
It was a conversation. We could hear both sides of it in the scene, but he carries that entire thing with just the expressions on his face and the intonations in his voice. But, you know, it feels almost like you're doing a split screen. And I got to give some credit to the person on the other end of that line, but I also have to give a lot of credit to Drez. When was that an audition scene? Did he just do that? How many takes was this? How did he get so raw to go from one place of, you know, pseudo, I wouldn't call it elation, but pride to absolute devastation by the time that scene cuts out?
Yeah. I don't think that was one of the audition scenes I gave him, but I did write it so that it was a one-sided. In the script, I wrote, you know, him on the phone in the parking garage and her voice being heard. That was always my intent. Now, I did chicken out and I shot the other side of her conversation because there were some voices saying to me, and some of them were my own voices, so I'm not blaming anybody. I'm a big fan of safety and having plenty of footage. I tell my student filmmakers all the time, if you think you might need it, shoot it. And if you don't need it in the end, you're not going to regret having shot it. It's not going to matter. And so I shot the other side of that conversation because I felt like I might regret this if I don't have it. But when the editor put it together, he put it together the way it was initially scripted. And I just thought it was there. And it's what you said. It's Drez nailing the performance of the guy having to go from And it's in the dialogue too that he's kind of doing almost like the five stages of grief. You know, he starts out by, you know, bargaining and the denial and whatever the stages are. I don't remember them, but he's kind of going through a variety of stages that he just handles so well. China was in the garage when we shot it, and in another part of the garage, so she was here and on set, but she was actually on the phone with him. So that he could act with her on the phone. Of course, we didn't record, we used her dialogue from another, I don't think we recorded her while she was on the phone with him. I think we recorded her separately later, but I think that's part of it, actors kind of giving to each other, and she knew that he would need to hear her do those lines.
Here's a question.
It was also 100 degrees and stifling hot.
So that wasn't a tear. That was just sweat.
It was both.
He was afraid of dying in that car.
No, Drez told me we were shooting in Texas in the summer. There were a number of times when Drez had to be wiped down, or they both did. And he hates this, but he sweats when he gets really hot, his nose starts to sweat. And he was very uptight about it as we were shooting. And a couple of times we cleaned him up, but we had these long takes where we couldn't stop to do it. And of course you're breaking the intensity if you do. And in the end, I just thought it was totally real and natural. Yeah, there's a tear forming in his eye, but he's also sweating. And it just feels like this is because the character is in a very stressful situation. So
this is, I think, one of your best movies.
Thank you.
Cinematography wise, it was great. Acting wise, great. I liked where we started because that's more of a fun, you know, situation, you know.
There's a little more, you know, joy in that one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But now that you're at this place where you're making really high-end, real indie movies, what is your plan or ambitions or desires or conflicted desires about the next level, which is different producers?
Yeah.
Bigger budgets, some well-known actors. I mean, myself, every other filmmaker who's been at it for a while, this is something we have to think about at the start of every project. So share some of those thoughts.
And also, did Sajiwa just come up with the name for your next film, Conflicted Desires?
That's right. That's a good one.
That sounds like a late night Cinemax movie. But, children of the 80s will get that reference. That's a good question. Well, you know, it's on the one hand, I have to be honest and say,
I should say, you can continue this way forever.
Yeah,
no need to go up to the next level.
And after every film, I kind of think, should I keep doing it this way or should I try to get to another level? And I always want to try to get to another level with my work, both with my work personally, but also, you know, in terms of the audience that's going to see this film. We tried to get, I'd say known actors, but I don't mean like, you know, we're not going to get A-listers. You know, we weren't trying for that. But we tried to reach out to, we and did reach out to at least one actor with a following of some sort. I think our offer was just too low for them to consider. And that's just the reality of the budget. You know, we didn't have a lot to work with. And so we went with the talent.
Was it Christopher Walken?
No. We went with the talent that, and I'm glad we did, because I think they nailed it.
The lead actors are great.
But you know, I said this when Where We Started came out, Sujua, because I think the actors in that were great. Mm-hmm. But if those exact performances were given by known actors who, you know, sell well on the indie circuit or in bigger films, the exact same performances, I think that film would have gone a lot further, mm-hmm. just because of the names in it. I mean, that's just the reality of the business. So mm-hmm. I don't begrudge that. And I would like to take advantage of it. I would love for, you know, this film to get seen and to give me the opportunity to make something slightly larger. I mean, that's kind of the route that a lot of indie filmmakers take. The downside to that is I'm able right now to make what I want to make, and I'm in control of that, other than in terms of, you know, working with other creative people who are going to, you know, butt heads sometimes, but ultimately it's my decision. And if I do what you're talking about, then I'm like working with people who are going to have control over that thing to a greater degree than I do. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid of that. I'm apprehensive because I haven't had to do it before, but I'd be willing to do it because I'd like to take, you know, let me put it this way. If Marvel Studios called and said, we'd really love you to take the next whatever, I'd be like, okay, I'm taking a leave of absence and finding a way to do that. And that's working within a system. And I'm comfortable with that. If you're comfortable with the system or with the people, you know, like I use Marvel as an example because you see Marvel stuff on my walls and I like Marvel movies and the television shows. But I think, you know, one of the things you hear from all the people who work with them is, yes, there are elements of control and there are things you can and cannot do, and they'll tell you what those are. But working with those people is a creative joy because they love what they're doing and they want to create something wonderful and excellent.
Yeah,
and
I'm comfortable
working within a system of control if it's with people who I trust.
Yeah, it's a director for hire gig Marvel stuff. I talked to some people who've done some stuff for Marvel, but yeah, all in all, I hear it's great. It's you know, it's definitely the next level.
Quite a few levels.
Next
up,
level,
yeah.
You know, like 10 times up from what indie stuff. But the downside is, yeah, you're making some next level stuff never get released because you don't have that control.
Yeah, true.
Well, I mean, at the very least, you know, you get a $10 million paycheck to direct a Marvel movie. Even if you hate it, it's 2 years of your life. You come back out and you funded your next, you know,
10 movies,
85 movie. I don't know. Right. What 5 million?
I wouldn't mind that part either. I wouldn't mind being able to pay off my mortgage and, you know, not worrying about the kids' college bills and that kind of thing. So,
one thing I want to get back to the just real quick to close out that loop on the garage scene. You mentioned that China was in the garage, you know, with Drez on the phone to help, you know, with that part of the conversation. But you also mentioned that you filmed her to get kind of coverage for that second side, which I think is a great idea because, like, what if something had happened with the Drez footage and you ended up having to do it as just a single one?
Yeah, right.
But did Drez watch, did you film the part where she was performing her lines before or after you shot the garage scene?
After it kept getting pushed on the schedule because even though I wanted to have it, it was one of the lesser important things because I didn't think I would need it, but I wasn't sure. So when we had a couple of days, like we had a rain out day or something like that, it was like, oh, well, we'll use that day that we were going to shoot that and we'll move that to another. And it was a short, you know, compared to his scene, hers is much less emotional. Mm-hmm. Because the tenor of her, you know, the reason that I stay on him the whole time with that is because, you know, I've described her as having already made a decision.
Yes.
And that's her emotional tenor in the conversation is I'm just going to do this and I've already made a decision. Whereas he has to deal with the emotions of that decision. And that's why I stayed on him. So it was a lot easy. I don't want to say easy. There's no easy acting job, but it's a comparatively easier, plus it wasn't in a hot garage, we set it in the apartment that they had been in early on. We just used the kitchen of that apartment, so it was just an easier thing to shoot. But it ended up waiting until I don't remember how much after we shot his, but it was definitely after.
Because what I was interested in is, since it's very interesting that you filmed that after that wonderful garage scene, because I assume that she had a chance to watch the performance and see what he was doing on the other end of that. You mentioned they were in separate parts of the garage. So she's talking into a phone.
Yeah.
He's acting, responding it to a different place, but she can't sit there and watch the amazing stuff that he's doing. And, you know, of course you have to cut the whole thing together. Did she have a chance to watch his performance? And if so, did you notice a difference in the way she delivered her performance when you were filming that scene later at the apartment?
Both of them were remarkably consistent from take to take when we were shooting. So, you know, that's one of the things that I don't think she watched it. We didn't, we never had a lot of time for things like watching dailies. So unless it's possible, she might've asked for that specifically, but I just don't remember her doing that now. So I don't think she did watch it. And I think her performance was very similar because she was so remarkably consistent from take to take of those things. But we went through it a lot to try and get on the day that we shot his, trying to figure out the right speed for some of those places where she would interrupt or where he that where it builds a little to a kind of an argument or a fever pitch kind of thing. Like, we had to work on those things. So I think that was probably all still in her head from us having done it already.
Because what I'm wondering is, given the way that he reacts to this news, his character does, and you can see that in the performance, I'm wondering, when you film that later, is there something in her that's like, okay, here's the part I saw how he was reacting and kind of getting emotional. Here's where I'm going to dig that knife. And like, just the, you know, this bit of intonation here.
Honestly, I think yes, but just not from having seen it, but just from having heard his performance.
From the script also, probably.
Yeah, from the script also. I mean, some of that was very specific in the script but then they would act it out and it wouldn't always quite play the same as I thought. And so we had to make some adjustments. And some of the stuff, there was a moment in there where I wanted them to kind of be stepping on each other's lines, and Drez just never quite could. There's a lot for him to say in that scene and to do all by himself on camera, and so and we weren't breaking it up. You know, a lot of scenes will be shot like, well, we'll shoot a little bit of it, we'll shoot a little bit more, but and we really wanted his to go all the way. And there was one piece that we never quite got the way I liked it in terms of them stepping on each other's lines and him kind of bubbling over and getting angry or sounding angry. And but this is why it's good to have an editor, because the editor didn't know what was in my head for that period, and he was like, no, I think the awkwardness of him quiet for a second really works instead, and then he picks up and says what he says, so like he's trying to think of something. So it's just stuff like that really that developed between the two of them performing it. And I think she knew what those were just from listening to him.
Quick thing before we close out. The cinematography is great, and the cinematographer is a star. What's he up to? Is he going to Hollywood?
Right before he took our film, and he did Blur Circle too, my previous film. He was the cinematographer on that, but there's 3 years difference experience level from one to the other. And I think that one's great too, but
this one is great.
It's better, yeah. So he had been working as a in-house DP at a marketing agency, and he decided, I'm going to go freelance. He'd done that for like 3 years, and he was ready to kind of go full-time freelance. And this film was his first project post that job. And so so he took it really seriously, like, this is going to be a launching point. And he's done several other indie films since then, and music videos and things that he's doing on his own, as well as commercials and stuff like that, because that pays the bills. But I don't know if he's going Hollywood. Not that he would mind, I'm sure, but I don't know what his plans are. He's in Texas as well as I am. Mm-hmm. So
he's got the skills. I learned that the guy who shot Mandalorian also shot the new Dune.
No, he's definitely got the skills. It's beautiful work. So I'm indebted to him. You know, there's a great creative collaboration that's like my vision for certain things, like the close-ups, the lingering close-ups and the long takes was something that I went into it with as a vision for what I wanted the film to be. But Aaron adds movement and energy to things where I'm not always leaning that way, in part because it's very hard to do that kind of stuff. Not very hard, but harder. Mm-hmm. And but he's always pushing for, no, we need to do this, we need to do this. So like slow push-ins on the actors as they're talking while we're doing like the stuff in the college reunion, that was all him, you know, pushing for those move-ins, and it works. It gives it more energy.
I want to kind of close out with my hot take and controversial opinion.
No controversy.
No, this movie was very hard for me to watch. Aesthetically, I think it's great for all the reasons we've discussed, that the performances are wonderful, but I ultimately had to consider this as the perfect movie for people to watch in pre-marriage counseling.
I'm not opposed to that opinion, by the way.
Well, here's the thing. I did not like Drez or Madison from the beginning of this movie to the end, because I think it was a problem of communication. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff that they talk about, you know, she rattles off a laundry list in the beginning, you know, which I won't get into the context of it, but she's like, you have to promise to love me even though I refuse to learn how to pick up after myself. If I decide that I want to sleep in all day instead of go to appointments that we have, and yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, no, that's not stuff you talk about right before you're getting married. And it's not something that you just assent to. But there's all these like little things that, and I'm not just trying to slam Madison. I mean, you know, Drez has his own foibles mm-hmm. too, but there are things that they are working out almost too late in these progressive steps along the relationship. And it's just really frustrating to me. You should see the notes in my notebook. There's a lot of exclamation points and underlining, but in the end, I'm like, this, even though I don't agree with these characters, I think it's a wonderful piece of filmmaking that could serve a message perhaps beyond the one that you intended, which is, if you're thinking of spending the rest of your life with someone, you know, you could have called this seven short films about our marriage. You could have just called it Red Flags the Movie.
Well, I definitely think that, you know, I went into marriage with a lot of naivete about what it takes to be married. And, yeah. And you know, it wasn't things like I knew my wife liked to sleep a lot. But when I was in college, I liked to sleep a lot too. And so, you know, I didn't think that was a problem. And that's not a problem. It's a minor thing. You know, it's, I think that one of the messages I was trying to convey was marriage is, there are going to be things that are going to be very hard, and marriage is about choosing to stay together and grow together and deal with those issues. And some of them, and the intent of the scene you're mentioning is that some of those things are really, they seem like small things when you love each other and you're all excited about getting married. And the truth is, they're not all small things. They can blossom into bigger things if you don't deal with them.
Right.
And that was a great note from somebody else, you know, who read the script, but she specifically remarked on that first scene. She said, those things need to come back and be problems that they deal with. And so some of the scenes where they do come back are a result of rewriting to kind of bring those ideas back. You know, she's late. She doesn't, you know, she's late all the time. They've argued about that at the college reunion. We get this, you know, we get a little dialogue about the fact that that was an argument they were having. You know, I wanted those things to be recurring problems that sounded really small when they were very naive and getting married, but which now they're still dealing with 10 years later. So because marriage is communication, that was one of the keys that we did in pre-marriage counseling. That was one of the main things they said was the most important thing, was communication. And I agree with you. It's, you know, you have, but when you're that young and naive, you don't even know which things you're supposed to be communicating about.
Also, one last thing. Also, don't marry indie filmmakers or live with them. Bad idea.
Yeah, I was trying to write that in a bit too.
Good. No, it got through.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big spoiler I'm not going to get to, but I'll just say that there is a central issue that I think represented a turning point in their marriage that my wife and I also went through. And
part three, you mean?
Possibly.
Okay. Don't spoil it to the audience.
I don't want to either. So
I will just mention that there is a conversation that happens and Drez decides he needs to go, I think, location scout.
Yes.
And I think no way in hell at that moment is he going to do that without even, you know, I love you or a hug. Not in that moment.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And I'm not saying that that's not authentic. I'm just saying that, again, you show that to a young couple starting out or thinking about getting married. Like, you think that this is in you, or if you think this is in your spouse, let's put on the brakes and have that conversation.
Well, and that's, yeah, I think that my version of what you just said would be, this is not the right way to handle this, because what's happening there is exactly what you're talking about, lack of communication. She's trying to communicate, but she's in a place where I'm trying not to spoil either.
Right.
A place where that's very hard for her. And he does not know how to respond to this because no one has prepared him for how to respond to this. And so, you know, I also was trying to convey that, and I'm not sure that this comes across in that scene in particular, that it's been a bit of time between, you know, it's not like the next day. And there are some people who who read it that way. And I'm not saying they're wrong, because it's a little hard to read. You know, like you talked earlier about how I'm not explicit about time.
Right.
And, you know, there's a fade out before it comes back in, and a fade out to me always means there's some passage of time. But I was trying to convey that there was some passage of time, and that she was, that her, the emotions she's dealing with there are certainly valid, but that it's been a while of her still kind of in this funk, and that he's just not sure how to deal with it. Both of which I think are pretty valid kind of points of view. In fact, one of the things I was going for on a lot of those situations is neither of them, I hear what you're saying, so don't take this the wrong way. I was trying to convey that they're not wrong. It's not you're wrong or you're wrong. It's that we're not dealing with this very well. You know, she's not dealing with a situation very well, and he has no idea how to deal with her not dealing with it well. And so they're not communicating. And as a result, you know, when they finally do communicate about this, that issue, it's like an explosion.
New revenue stream. Sell this to, you know, 10,000 marriage counselors.
Yeah.
License it. $1,000 per license.
There you go.
He gets a cut.
Yes, I want my 1% finder's fee for the idea. 0.5%, because Tajiwa gets the other.
That's right.
No, but Chris, thank you very much for helping us inaugurate this new endeavor.
Indie film explosion.
Woo! And congratulations on the movie. And you know, I hope it leads to bigger and you know, better. That sounds really bad. It's not bigger and better.
I know what you mean. No
bigger
worries.
Opportunities, you know, that kind of a thing. Yeah, next level stuff, whether it be the next Marvel movie or
if you want.
Yeah. But yeah, so Julia, do you have anything before we close out?
I think people should watch Chris Hansen movies, talented filmmaker. And I think who do we have next month? Is it Dan Mirvish?
I don't know if we've heard back.
Okay, we'll follow up. We'll figure it out. And okay. hopefully in a week or two we can discuss the Secret Society for Slow Romance, and I'm sure we'll have Chris back on for other projects.
I would love to.
Yeah, so I guess to close things out, what do you have, you know, boiling next? Are you working on some, like, the next story, or are you just what's going on?
I'm working on, I have a couple of script ideas that I've been toying with, one of which is kind of bubbled to the top, but I can't say too much about it yet because it's so fresh. It's just so I haven't gotten very far with it, so there's not a lot to say other than
underdeveloped.
But and then there's another possible project that would be a little more freelance oriented, not a film, but a part of a series of vignettes for from an already published work. So
it's not a hamburger bun commercial, is it?
no, that came straight from the DP's experience, by the way, of working with marketing agency, having to deal with those kinds of clients. So
made me think of Mad Men.
I'm sure, but he had his own, a lot of that dialogue and the bite and smile, that was directly from his experience with marketing. Yeah, so a couple of things in the hopper, potentially. I honestly had a hard time writing throughout the pandemic, and I haven't really broken that rut quite yet. So, but I have these, I'm like a desire to kind of get back to it and write something and get, so I'm thinking about either one of these things is going to bubble to the surface and I'm going to write it. It's going to finally come to me. Or maybe I work with another writer and find a script that I really want to do and pursue that. You know, the filmmaker I mentioned earlier, who's a friend of mine, you know, recommended I consider doing that. And that's something I'm thinking about too. So,
well, nothing awesome. But possibilities, man. That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, thank you very much, Chris. Thank you, Tajiwa.
Good show.
Yes. Check out, I'll have links to everybody's stuff down below. Or if you're listening to the podcast, that'll be in the description. Thanks everyone for checking out Indie Scene. If you like this, like, subscribe, do that, all that great stuff. And we'll be back next month with something or other. More hot takes. Yeah.
Donate lots of money to Ian, even though he doesn't want to take it.
I don't have time to set up a Patreon. I don't.
No problem. No problem. Yeah.
All right. Take care, gang.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Good job. See ya.